Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go through 168 to 4 BC in the framework books, and you can kind of see where you're at. I've got all the stuff on the screen to look at. We've got the Greece period between Alexander the Great, which we talked about last time, up to the Syrian Wars, which take place between 323 and 168. The Syrian Wars are the generals. When Alexander dies, his generals divide up the empire, and the king of the south, Daniel talked about it, is the kings, the Ptolemies in Egypt, fighting against the Syrians, and they're called the Syrian Wars. And right in the middle of all of that, here's the coast, here's Egypt, here's Israel right here, and here's Syria up here. When they go back and forth and fight, they're fighting right through Israel right here. And so whoever controls, the Syrians push the border down to Egypt, Egypt pushes the border up to Syria, and Israel's like a ping pong ball being moved back and forth. And so Israel's very important in all of these Syrian wars. Eventually, they start to oppress the Jews, one of the kings, Antiochus Epiphanes, and Judas Maccabeus or his family, Mattathias and Mattathias' five sons, start the Maccabean Revolt. We kind of introduced that last time from 166 to 160. And then they established kind of, they drive out the Syrians and they just, the Syrians kind of backed off and gave them the territory. And then the descendants of Judas Maccabeus and his brothers, they become known as the Hasmoneans because they were priests. They were from the priestly tribe, the Judas's father. Now, this is not Judas in the Bible. This is probably where a lot of people got their name Judas from, was because of the hero Judas of the Maccabean Revolt. Mattathias and Judas and his brothers, their ancestor was Hasmon, which was the Hasmonean priestly line. So these are the priests. They start ruling Israel. And he goes from 157 to 46 B.C. And then about that time, Rome is rising in power, and they need to get Rome involved in it. And here you notice right here, Antipater and his sons, and that his sons are Phasael and Herod, and they're coming from Idumea, or the Edomites. So all of this is taking place. We've got a lot of things to take a look at tonight. Here's in review, Alexander left Greece, Pella, comes all the way through here, sweeping through, goes all the way over to Persia, moves into India, and comes back and dies here in this area in Babylon. And at that point, his generals divide the kingdom up. And in 323, Alexander arrives back in Babylon at the age of 32. He's worn out from his wounds and hardships. And on June 11th, he's sick with a fever and dies. Now, what's interesting, and I didn't talk about it, I don't think, last time, when he dies, it was, they said it was a miracle. It was amazing because his body didn't begin to decay until 8 days after his funeral. Which, if you go back into modern medicine, he was not dead. He was in a coma, or he had a disease that he was in a state that he couldn't move. And so he was conscious during his entire funeral procession, possibly, and he just couldn't blink. He couldn't move. Again, that's speculation. You've either got this miracle that his body didn't start to decay until 8 days after his funeral, or, well, he wasn't dead until 8 days after his funeral, or 5 days or something. But anyway, that's interesting. And this is where the kings take over. And you see Lysimachus goes back, and he's out of our story. Antipater and Cassander goes back up into this area. Antigonus, Ptolemy, and then Seleucus. And Seleucus loses right away, and Antigonus is going to be the king of the north, and Ptolemy's the king of the south. And that's where our story's now going to go back and forth right here with these kings. Here's just some information. I've got, you don't have these notes. They're on paper that's online. These are just the kings of Persia, the kings of the Seleucid Empire, just kind of paralleling who's going with who at the same time. You can see this on the notes. Here's the Roman emperors. Julius Caesar arises here. Antipater, an Idumean, and his sons are arising right about here. Here's the civil war between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. All that is just listed here. Here is, again, our map. Antigonus and Ptolemy, the king of the south that Daniel talked about. And there's going to be a series of them. There's not just going to be one. He just refers to the king of the south. And whenever the prophecies refer about the king of the south, it could be Ptolemy the first, Ptolemy the second, Ptolemy the first, or whoever comes after them, or Antigonus, or the Seleucids are going to also be reigning. They're going to blend together right here. These are the generals, again, of Alexander. Here's a list of the kings. In the king of the south, Ptolemy's kingdoms, Ptolemy the first, Soter, they always have a last name, but that means, Soter in Greek means savior, so Ptolemy the savior, Ptolemy the Philadelphus, meaning, you know, the lover, Ptolemy the third, and they go all the way down through. So these are all Ptolemies until you get to Cleopatra. and they're arraigned. That's the king of the south. Over here, the kings of the north is Seleucid, Nicator, Antiochus, Soter, Antiochus, Theos. That's Antiochus, the god, the savior. And then Antiochus the third, the great, which was a good leader. But then comes Antiochus the fourth, which is the forerunner of the Antichrist. Well, how he behaves, some of Daniel's prophecies were about the Antichrist that we think about. That's Antiochus Epiphanes. He's the one that started the persecution of the Jews and wouldn't let them circumcise, try to wipe out Judaism. He dies, and Antiochus the fifth takes over. But Antiochus the fourth, or Epiphanes, doesn't fulfill all of the end time prophecy, so that he dies, and there's some things left unfulfilled, which means some of these things are going to be cycled through again historically. And then there you got the land of Egypt. There's you got the land of Israel, that's ravaged by these wars continually. And here is the same map, but I've got, and these are some coins right here. I'd like to pass them way around, but I got so much stuff to pass around. You can come up and take a look at some of them if you'd like to. But these coins are all laying here. For you to look at if you'd like to, and I'll show you here on the map. But Ptolemy the First Soter, this is his, or his one of his coins. Ptolemy the Fourth, that's one of his coins. And then there's a, notice there's an elephant. It says Basileu, which means kingdom. And that's Antiochus the Third, Antiochus the Great, right before Antiochus Epiphanes shows up. And they used elephants in warfare. So those are some of there. And here's a close-up of those emperors. There you can see he's got an elephant. Well, I looked at this last time, I think. But he's got the bronze head of the Alexandria wearing a elephant skull, which is a sign of the Egyptian deity Ammon. So he's wearing the headpiece of Ammon, the high priest. There's the back. There's an eagle. Eagles have been popular since the Greeks. You know, the Romans had them. Here's a Roman eagle right here, an actual Roman eagle that was on some decoration. And there's another. I just got it on another bronze piece there. But, you know, they had them. We've got eagles. Everybody's got eagles. There is a lamp. I got some ancient oil lamps. This is a Hellenistic Grecian from 300 to 1 BC. I've got that downstairs. Here's some papyrus from this time period, 200 BC. Manuscripts written on papyrus. There's those things again, pictures of them, how they're fragments from 200 BC. Here's a list of the Jewish high priests from 521 to 490 when Joshua the high priest listed in the Bible. Jonathan was a high priest, and Jaddua is mentioned in the Bible, going all the way down here until Jonathan Maccabeus. It gets interrupted right here around 162, 159, kind of cut off because of the Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of the north, kind of cuts him off. But then after Mattathias and his sons revolt, Judas and his brothers drive everybody back, one of his brothers, Jonathan Maccabeus, becomes the high priest, is followed by Simon Maccabeus, and now you're into John Hyrcanus, and now you're into the Hasmonean dynasty of the priests, and that's not always a beautiful setting. It continues all the way down to the very last one we've got written right here, Joseph Caiaphas, and that's the one who tried Jesus, and a lot of these guys pop up in and out of Scripture at different times. Here's again some more coins. In my mind, I thought this would be fun to look at them. Oh, there's that. That's the head of one of the Seleucid kings from the north. It's not printed right, and that's the back of it. That's the elephant. So these are in circulation during our story tonight. There's just close-ups of those. Oh, finally some notes. Okay, here we go. Now, these are on page 156, possibly, in your book. Is that right? Because I took this off. The paging got mixed up on my PDF online. But anyway, so 182 B.C. So we're starting in 182 B.C. Alexander has died. We've had the Ptolemies and the Seleucids have already started. But there's a guy named Joseph, a Tobias. One of the wives has seven sons. The other wife has one, Hyrcanus. Joseph sent Hyrcanus to congratulate Ptolemy on the birth of his son, so that's the king. And while he was there, he found out, we left off with this, where he found out that there's people collecting taxes for the empire, if it be the Ptolemies or the Seleucids. And he bids to get that job as a tax collector. So here comes in the tax collectors. The high priest Simon the Second sides with his father Joseph, and the five remaining sons are now the two divisions of issues of the Jerusalem. The Pharisees are the Hellenizers, and Joseph is the tax collectors. Joshua sends Menelaus to Antiochus the Fourth. That's the great. That's before Antiochus Epiphanes come. The payment of the high priest to buy the high priest position. Whoever has the high priest position in Jerusalem has power. But Menelaus offers 300 talents more, so Menelaus gets the priesthood in Jerusalem. So this is the guy operating the temple, is buying the priesthood from the Seleucid, or from Antiochus in the north. Menelaus then robs the temple treasury for some gold vessels because he owes people some money for getting him into this position. Onias the Third, the true high priest who lost his position, the one that was actually functioning, can you see all this taking place just in religion, how it becomes political, it becomes power-based, financial, and now we've got corruption. This is the fulfillment of Daniel chapter 11, verse 22, where it talks about this individual or the righteous one being removed. 170 to 168, the sixth Syrian war. Now the Syrian wars are these. The king of the south fighting the king of the north, and they've had a series of wars, and it goes back and forth. Here, Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, is successful. That's the forerunner of the Antichrist. So you see the priesthood being sold in here by this forerunner of the Antichrist, and he is an image, a perfect image of the Antichrist. And so you can see how that's compromised, and you'd expect something like that to take place coming up. But in the sixth Syrian war, Ptolemy declares war on Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes is successful, and the two regents who led Egypt for that very young Ptolemy the Sixth are killed. So the king, as because it's royalty, they may be boys, become the king, and someone's got to rule for him. Well, Antiochus the Fourth actually takes the young Ptolemy the Sixth into his own guardianship. He said, well, I'll just take that king and raise him up here as a good solution. Now, these guys are both Greeks. These are two Greek divisions from Alexander the Great that are trying to get their own kingdoms. Alexandria in Egypt revolts, and Antiochus lays siege to Alexandria. So you got the sixth Syrian war, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, the Roman Senate gets involved, Jerusalem is under control of the Seleucids, which is the north, Daniel 11 is taking place. So the Roman Senate is forming right here, trying to figure out there where they're going to run their government. They're not a world power yet, but they're going to be. Now, Hellenism. And again, remember what Hellenism is. That's Greek culture. It has nothing to do with hell. It's got to do with Helen and the style. It'd be like, you know, Western culture. This would be Hellenism coming out of the Greek culture. It began with Alexander the Great. Greek culture or Hellenism came to Jerusalem in art, literature, philosophy, religion, civic life, government, and as a product of city life. Now, this is a problem because Israel, Jerusalem, has their law. They've already got their culture. They're given direction by God. Well, this coming in, it's not necessarily evil in its sense. It's just not the way they're supposed to be doing it. They're taking their eye off of God's direction and imitating the world. And so you can see a lot of things going on in the world, and you can say, well, they're not right, or they're wicked, they're evil. Well, sometimes they're neutral. They're just, that's the way they dress. That's the way they sing. That's what the foods they eat. But if God's giving you direction to keep you in the straight and narrow, that's kind of where you're supposed to be at. Now, of course, we see in our culture, the dress has got corrupt, the drinking, the food has got corrupt, the music has got corrupt, the halftime entertainment's got corrupt. That's all. It's one thing just get a different culture, but it's also can, if you don't have the word guiding you, it can deviate. So Greek city life included sports. So now, when was the last time you read, you know, David being mighty in sports? Or, you know, Samson, you know, he went to the game and scored more goals. It's like they're military, they're fighting, they're hunting. But now all of a sudden the Jews are going to be Hellenized, and sports are important. They build a gymnasium in Jerusalem. Hellenism focused on enjoying this life. Judaism focused on glorifying God. That's probably the biggest difference. Their theater for dramatic presentations was created, gymnasiums for training, stadiums for athletic contests, the hippodrome. I should have thrown up a picture of the hippodrome. There's still the remains of a hippodrome right there at Caesarea by the sea, right by Herod's old palace. The bleachers are still there. You can look down, you can see the center beam, and not beam, but the center portion of the track, and just where the chariots would race around. Well, it's right where Herod, not Herod the Great, but Herod Agrippa, the first died in the book of Acts, where he was there and he had a silver outfit on, shining in the sun. Maybe he overheated. Josephus records the same thing, but he was at that event, at that Colosseum or at that Hippodrome dome in Caesarea, looking right out over the Mediterranean Sea, and he passed out, possibly because of the sun. But it says worms in the Bible, Acts, as worms began to eat him. And Josephus records the same thing. A few days later, worms crawled out of his body. So the writer of Acts just says the worms killed him. Josephus gives you the details. He passed out. He was put in, took care of him, and a couple days later, the worms began to crawl out of his body. And so anyway, that's not even anything to do, but that is an example of a hippodrome in the book of Acts. Paul, when he was in trial or in prison with Herod Agrippa II, or Festus and Felix right there at Caesarea, he could look, I mean, the hippodrome was right there. So Paul is going to move through this Hellenistic culture, which is morphed into the Roman culture. Colonnaded streets for shops, agoras for marketplace, meetings, stoas. In 169, while Antiochus IV is dealing with Jerusalem, the young Ptolemy VI sides with his brother in Egypt, which makes sense because he's from Egypt. Having lost power in Egypt, Antiochus IV invades. So he's coming down here. He's got the little boy up here, but his brother now, it says no. So Antiochus Epiphanes is going to go down here and invade, and we've covered this before. Antiochus Epiphanes leaves Egypt and goes to Jerusalem. A rumor rises back in Jerusalem that Antiochus IV has been defeated. And so he is oppressing this Hellenism on the Jews, but when he goes down here, he gets in some trouble and he needs to come back up here to reinforce himself, but they think that he's been killed down in Egypt, so they start celebrating. In 168, the Roman Senate, being interested in their supply of grain from Egypt, sends Gaius Poppius Lanius to Alexandria. Alexandria is on the coast, named after Alexander, of course, one of many cities named after Alexander. So Lanius comes from Rome down here to make sure they get their grain supply. When Antiochus IV arrived from his victories in Egypt, in the city of Memphis, Lanius meets Antiochus IV outside Alexandria, we talked about this, and gives him an ultimatum. The Roman military is now there. We're checking on our food supply. He's invading the land, causing chaos. Israel's going to hear about this conflict and think Antiochus Epiphanes has been killed and they're going to be free from the oppression of the Hellenists. But he's given an ultimatum, Antiochus, the Antichrist of the book of Daniel, for this time period. They tell him to evacuate Egypt. When Antiochus says he needs time to think about it, Linnaeus, the Roman general, draws a circle around him in the sand with his cane and tells him to decide before he leaves that circle. We've got all day. Well, you decide what you're going to do, if you're going to have me fight you or if you're going to leave in peace. Well, he turns, of course, and he's outraged but agrees and heads back to secure his new territory in Jerusalem. He comes back up here when he finds them celebrating. In December, Antiochus hears the report that Jerusalem is in revolt against the Hellenistic practices, and Menelaus, who he's put in as the high priest. Antiochus, the Antichrist, has put the high priest in position, Menelaus, in Jerusalem. Now, he is not the Antichrist. He's a forerunner of the Antichrist. But notice how you got the king of Syria controlling the priesthood here with a Jewish priest in position, getting in trouble with Rome, coming back. And now Antiochus arrives in Jerusalem, begins to punish the Jews and saves Menelaus because they've turned on him. Homes are looted and burned. Thousands of women and children are sold into slavery. Menelaus leads Antiochus Epiphanes, or the Antichrist, into the temple. Together the two plunder it, desecrate it. And on December 25th, 168, an altar of Zeus is built and replaces the altar of burnt offerings outside the temple. So what you have is Antiochus Epiphanes and the high priest desecrating the temple and then changing the whole religious system to worship Zeus, you know, the god of the Greeks, and changes the offering. The image or statue of Zeus is placed in the Holy of Holies, behind the curtain. Of course, the Ark of the Covenant is gone. It never came back from Babylon, or it was hidden or melted down or something, or Jeremiah hid it. Again, there's all kinds of speculation. An image or statue of Zeus is placed in the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant would have sat, that resembles his face. Of Zeus is the face of Antiochus the Epiphanes himself. So you've got the forerunner, the Antichrist, his image is on the face of the God who's in the holy place. The Jews are forced to worship the image by offering swine flesh, which of course they can't even eat, let alone bring into the temple, cut it and offer it as a burnt sacrifice. 167, a year later, Menelaus is restored as the high priest in Jerusalem. Soldiers force Jews to build altars and make sacrifices to Zeus and worship Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means the enlightened one. Epiphanes, the enlightened. He's like the enlightened, guided from God, and or the manifestation of God in flesh. And they're building these altars on street corners. So you go into Jerusalem at this time, on the street corners are altars with poles dedicated to Zeus, which is Antiochus Epiphanes' image, and everyone's offering. Now some, I mean, what would happen in our culture if they did something like that? Some would be like, well, whatever. You know, do I get a raise at work? Do I get to keep my... They would just go about their day. It wouldn't have any effect. Some would not think it's right, but they don't want any conflict. They'd cooperate. Well, that same thing's happening here. People are just going along with it. And there's some that are like, this isn't right. Torahs are burnt. They start burning the scriptures. When they say Torah, they're burning the Bible. They're burning the Old Testament. Circumcision is forbidden, and violators are tortured and killed. There's stories of women that circumcise their children, and then they were then tortured for having done that. Modin is in the hills of Gophna. Now, this is a city, a little village of the Hasmoneans. Jerusalem is right here. You can see the coast. The Seleucid officer Apelles and his detachment of soldiers arrived in Modin one morning. Here's where everybody's going with it. Here's where the Maccabean revolt begins. The Seleucid officer coming out of the north, Apelles, for Antiochus Epiphanes, comes to Modin, a small village here. They're going to be going through all these villages, and they've got altars on the street corners. They've got altar in an image in the temple. Well, they just want to make sure all these rural cities are cooperating. So they come here, and to the city, there's the leader is a high priest, or not the high priest, but a priest. He'd probably, just like John the Baptist's father, would come and serve his month or his week time in the temple and then return to his rural area where he would live. This Mattathias probably lived, well, he does live in Modin, but then would take, when it was his turn, he would go in and serve his turn as the one of the priests that do the sacrifices, and one, maybe he had a chance to burn the incense offering one time like John the Baptist's dad did Zechariah when the angel appeared to him. But he was a priest, but they had so many priests that they'd only serve a week or 2 weeks or a month, and they'd return and they'd have like a career or another job. Well, Mattathias, an older Jew, is told, they bring in the battalion, comes in, the soldiers come in with an image of Zeus, and they go to create an altar and with a sacrificial axe, and they tell him, because you're the priest, that they will give him, if he will offer this pig on this altar here, it's just kind of like a transportable altar, and with the axe and the pig, they have a little pig on a string, that they'll give him a purple cloak, a floppy purple hat, and priestly garments for the Hellenistic priest, and promise him gold and favor with Antiochus Epiphanes. Now you say, well, I don't want a floppy purple hat, but if it was, whatever's in style right now, I don't even know what's in style right now. You know, I would say bell-bottom blue jeans, but that, you know, that's a long time ago. But they give him what was really cool in the culture was the purple cloak, the purple floppy hat, and it's like, we'll give you this if you'll kill this pig and lead your community into Zeus worship, and we've got this town taken care of. Mattathias replied, although all the Gentiles in the king's realm obey him, so that each forsakes the religion of his fathers and consents to the king's orders, yet I and my sons and my kinsmen will keep to the covenant of our fathers, the Old Testament, the law of Moses. God forbid that we should forsake the law and commandments. God forbid that we should turn our backs on the word of God. We will not obey the words of the king, nor depart from our religion in the slightest degree. In other words, it's like, no, kill me. I'm not changing. I'd rather die being faithful to the word of God than keep myself alive and forsake and lead others to forsake it. Well, then a Hellenistic Jew from the community, from the village, stepped forward and accepted the offer. I'll do it. I want a floppy purple hat and a purple garment, and I'd like to have favor with Antiochus Epiphanes. Filled with righteous fury, Mattathias, who is an old man with five adult sons, Mattathias sprang out of the crowd and slew the apostate Jew on the altar. He grabs the axe and kills the Jew on the altar. And, of course, now we've got a now we've just started the Maccabean revolt. And then he commanded, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and who stands by the covenant follow me." Knowing their village would be burnt and that the citizens would be killed, the villagers left with their sheep, their goats, and their cattle. Everybody packs up, they take their food with them, that they're not taking them their pets, they're taking their food supply. They're all their animals. In the steep wooded area of Gophna, 9 miles northeast of Modin. Modin, they went northeast into the hills of Gophna. Again, I'm going to show you some pictures of the territory here so you can see what's going on. Remember, this is the coastal plain. This is the Mediterranean Sea, so this is flat area right here. Then you're going to have some rolling hills in this area, and they're rolling up to the high ridge that runs down the middle, and Jerusalem, in a sense, is on a mountain. But it's not like Colorado Mountain. You look at the mountains, it just keeps climbing up to a rocky ridge right here in the middle. So you're going to have the coastal plain, the Shephela, which is the green grass rolling into hills, then the hill country, like the hills of Gophna, and then it's going to get up here to the high place when you get up to the very top of that ridge. And from the top of the ridge, you look down into the Dead Sea, the lowest place on earth. And on this side, you can look down in the Mediterranean Sea. Now, again, you can't just look like here and this way. It's not quite that easy. But in a sense, that's about, you could almost see if you could see far enough. I know you, well, I'll show you some pictures. So that's where they're at. They go up here in the hills and they realize we're in trouble. And they killed all the soldiers. See, it says, and they just slaughtered them. Okay, and that's that map right there. Now, Maccabean revolt begins with gain support of the Hasidim. That's the holy ones or the pious ones, the Hasidim. From the hills of Gophna, Mattathias and his sons would visit villages at night to recruit men, tip over altars, kill Hellenistic Jews. Now, not this, of course, Modin was not the only village that was approached with a pig and an altar and a sacrificial axe. It was the only village that says, no way. And they attacked the guards. You know, they risked their life. But they're out now hiding in the woods. But all these other villages, like, they didn't have a Mattathias. They didn't have the five sons. They didn't have that bold stand. So they've all got pigs and sacrificial altars. So at night, they would go off and they would tip over those altars. They'd kill any of the Jews that had the purple floppy hat and the purple coat, you know, and they're all, you know, transcultural or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, I tried to be funny there. And they would just... they just killed him and kept going. 166, Mattathias dies. Again, he's an old man. Some dates are like 120, 130 years old. I mean, I don't know how, but it's like... So then Judas Maccabeus, his name's Judas right now, just Judas, son of Mattathias. He'd probably be Judas ben Mattathias, or, you know, son of Mattathias. But nonetheless, Judas, but he's a Hasmonean, because that's the priestly family, becomes a leader and strikes with such force, he becomes known as the Hammer. It's Judas the Hammer, but they don't speak English, they speak Hebrew, so he's Judas Maccabeus, which means the Hammer. So Judas Maccabeus, that just means the Hammer, and that's not a real family name. Judas the Hammer, or Judas Maccabeus, finds success even though he's untrained, unequipped, with unequipped men to face this. Judas Maccabeus takes control of villages north of Jerusalem. So right up here is Jerusalem, and then north up here, from anything north, we'll look at some pictures of this area, he takes control of those in the hills. So all the villages are now under his control, and people are, you got a leader, they've got momentum. It's like, yeah. They find isolated Seleucid patrol, like they'll be out patrolling the Seleucid. Now, Seleucids are the kings of the north. You know, it's Antiochus Epiphanes at this time, Antiochus and Seleucia. That's the two family names that flip back and forth. So this is the Seleucid Empire. This is the Ptolemy Empire, or that's the two kings. It just happens that Antiochus is the king at this time. So the Seleucid soldiers are divisions of soldiers that are working for the Greeks or Antiochus Epiphanes. They find isolated troops or patrols, kill them, bury their bodies, take their weapons. They search patrol that, then they wait for the search patrol. So they eliminate a patrol and they go, well, someone's going to come looking for them. So they get in the trees and they wait, and here comes someone out. Well, I wonder where they are. They probably got lost. They probably don't pay it. And then they killed that and buried their bodies and took their weapons. And so this area now becomes, I mean, we got gang warfare going on basically. It's like you can't control the streets. And now you can see the political tension here. Why doesn't Antiochus Epiphanes get this under control? You've got people running this area. It's dangerous. It's out of control. So in this case, we're cheering for the gangs right here. They attack and kill the third patrol. They continue the attacking patrols until Jerusalem stops sending patrols out. See, all the patrols, because this is the headquarters, Jerusalem, where the temple's at, they're sending troops out. And so this now becomes Judas Maccabeus' territory, and the Seleucids don't dare go into there. So what they do, they bring in ICE, or they bring in the military. And that's what they do. They bring in one of the generals who's had military war experience. I mean, he's gone to other countries and he's on a world battle scene. You can certainly take care of this country boy and his brothers. And so they bring in the general Apollonius with 3,000 troops against, now this time Judas doesn't have just four brothers, he's got 1,000 people with him. And it goes on, talks to Apollonius, the Seleucid, with 3,000 troops. Here's what happens. Judas sets up his troops along a narrow winding uphill with both sides of the pass with slings and stones. So there, you can imagine, you don't just go up the hill, you're going to have to go through, you know, just like you can follow roads, they go between hills or they go through the valleys. And so there's going to be a trail for them to march their troops up. But sometimes you can't stay in formation. You're going to have to go through narrow passes. You know, maybe you go one, you know, abreast or two or three abreast to get through. And so they're not really in formation. So Judas is waiting for them. And when they get there, they attack them with slings, stones, archers, one group, and then there'd be a group standing at the top of the hill. So on the sides of this pass, they just wait until Judas would show himself with a group he calls the faithful. That's his own personal bodyguard that he's got. And he would show himself at the top, and they go, there he is, let's go get him. And they'd start to get up the path, going up to attack him. And while they're going up, they'd be attacked by two other groups of Judas's men from the sides. The Seleucid troops are slaughtered, Apollonius is killed, and Judas takes the governor's sword. So Apollonius right here, he loses this battle, Judas kills him and ends up with his sword. And there's that battle right there, Apollonius, 3,000 troops are killed. So now you've got a legitimate general with 3,000 troops just been defeated in the hills of Gophna by this. So they send out next guy, Seron, 6,000 troops. Now Judas has got, they doubled theirs, and Judas added 200. So now 166, here's that map. Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, the forerunner of the Antichrist, plans to annihilate the Maccabean rebels and sends in General Seron. All right, we've had enough. We're just going to kill them all this time. Okay, let's do that. So General Seron leads 6,000 Seleucid troops down the Mediterranean coast. See, they're going to come down the Mediterranean coast, you see, and then they're going to pass through the Shephela, go up into, they're going to go through Modin. Now, I'm going to show you some pictures, because my very first time I was in Israel in 2007, you know, I'd taught this and I'd, you know, read about it, and we're on this winding pavement road going up. It's four lane, maybe two lane some places, and we're going up, and right there as we're going up is a sign with an arrow. It's got something in Hebrew, but in English it says Modin, and it got an arrow pointing over. It's like, oh my gosh, and there is the tombs of the Maccabees are there. And so as I was going up this very same place right here, there's still a road, because where the troops marched 2,000 years ago is where they built the roads today, because the hills and the mountains haven't moved in that sense. And so the terrain is the same. So he's going to march in here, go through this, go past Modin, and go up into Lower Beth Horon, because Judas controls all of this now. Judas chooses to meet him with 1,200 men on a steep, narrow pass between Lower Beth Horon and Upper Beth Horon. And Lower Beth Horon and Upper Beth Horon are here's a city or a little village on this part, and you go further up, that's upper. So you got lower and upper, just as you go past them. So he's going to meet them there. Two of the sides, he talks about all that. He shows himself, they come up, they find themselves trapped. Archers and slingers, the same thing, tearing at them. General Sharon is killed. The Seleucids tear off their armor, throw down their weapons, and are chased back to the coastal plain. And their general's gone, and they throw all their weapons down. And of course, now they just, that's their weapons program. That's how they get their weapons. And that is the second time that, now here we go, here we go. This is Tony. There's the Mediterranean Sea back here. You see right here? This is moving towards the hill country. This is the coastal plain. See how flat that is? And the armies would march back and forth along the Mediterranean coast, which makes sense. And then right up here, it starts to roll. You got some, you know, the grass fields, the Shephelah, and then it goes into the hill country right here. Here it is again. This is another picture. There's the Gaza Strip right here. There's Gaza. This is Ashkelon, and that's a Philistine city. And this would be a road. Well, this is where we drove. We drove here. Like this. That's why I did all these right up through here. And there's Beersheba. And so there's some pictures of some road signs as we go. There's Gaza. We're within 5 miles of Gaza City. There's Raphia, the crossing into Egypt. Right here's the border. You cross into Egypt right here, or you're in Philistine territory, or you're in Israel. Or if you live right there, where are you at? You're like, well, you're within range. There's a checkpoint right here. But anyway, that you kind of gives an image right there. Here's Jerusalem is underneath this part of the picture right here, but the hill country would go up there. Now, this is, we're going down that road right here. We're going right here, right about here. See right here? There's a road sign, and it says Gaza right there. That's Gaza City. So the Gaza Strip is like right on the other side. They're going south. Gaza Strip is right there. And then the Gaza City, one of the signs said 5 miles. So the Gaza City was 5 miles away. This is just an interesting sign, I thought, because we're going on down, firing on both sides of the road. So keep your head down. Okay. Now this is coming off the coastal plain. Beth Shemesh, remember where Gaza Strip right here? This is Philistine territory. And the Philistines got the Ark one time. And then they passed through 5 Philistine cities. Ashkelon was one of them. And then they put it on a cart and sent it back to Israel. And the cows took it back through the valley. They just followed the valley. And they came out at Beth Shemesh. That's the house of the sun is what basically what it means. And it goes, so you go right here. You can see the hills starting to come right here. This, you follow this road. It's probably or possibly... something at least very similar where the cows would have taken, the mother cows would have taken the cart with the Ark of the Covenant to Beth Shemesh. Anyway, now there's some hill. That's the hill country of Judea or Judah. You're looking at this is not the place yet. But there you can see we're going off the coast through the Shephelah. Now you're into the hills of Judah. And there's Tony standing, you know, look at, you see where she's at. There's just hills there, and we're moving to the center. There's more. And see right there? I captured it one time. In 2012, I thought, I'm getting a picture of it. We went back and didn't get it in 2010. In 2012. Now, that guy right there, who's got the microphone talking, I just thought I'd show you. That's Carl Rasmussen. That's the guy that wrote this right here. He wrote the Atlas to the Bible for Zondervan. And so that's him talking. And, of course, I was listening as much as I could, but, Carl, I've got to take pictures, too. And so... if you can imagine, I'm teaching class, and you know, Steve's taking pictures out the door, and you know, looking around the house, taking. It's like that's having Galen in your class in Israel. But anyway, that says, well, here it is. So we're going up. See, we're going up off this from the Shephelah, from the coastal plain Shephelah, going up into the territory. Well, Modin, that's exactly where the Maccabean revolt began. That's where they slaughtered. And there it is, right there. You see? Now this time we're going to the plain. We're not going up. We're going down out of the hill, out of Jerusalem. See right there, it says Modin right there. So now you can, so you see, this would be, see how the road winds? Because it's probably following a natural, and this would be where, this could be where one of Sharon's military is winding up, and Judas was on one side or on the front, and the troops or his division. There it is again, just another picture of that. And again, Modin, just so if you didn't see it. And now we're going down. So this is where this all took place, in this general area. Okay, Sharon is defeated. We just went here. He came here, and Lower Beth Horon is defeated and then is killed. Here we're still going down there. Oh, see right here? This is natural where they would have went. So this would be where you can see troops of Judas Maccabeus is up here hiding, and Judas at the top going, "Come and get me." And they got to walk. They're walking uphill to engage in battle, and Judas is just waiting for them to get there, and they're exhausted. And then by the time they see them, he gives a trumpet call or shofar call, and these guys start raining down slings and arrows on the troops, and Judas just picks up the weapons and goes home. It's like, and these guys say, "Well, that's not how you fight a war." It's kind of like, "Oh, welcome to our home game." Now you're getting higher. You're up by north of Jerusalem where you're very, very high. This you can't tell right here, but this is high. This is as high as you get. On that side, you start to go downhill to the Mediterranean Sea. On this side, you start going down. You got the Kidron Valley, Mount of Olives, and then you start going down to Jericho, the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea. There's some high places over here. I'm going to take you right here. Right here, there's some high places up here. In fact, that's kind of where we're at. We're up here looking back at that territory. There, you're looking towards Jerusalem. There, 1, 2, 3. See those? Those are the three. Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem down here. This is north of Jerusalem at a high place. It's Nabi Samuel. It's the prophet Samuel's burial place where the ark was set, where Solomon came and offered all the animals, and God appeared to him, and he said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want wisdom." That was up here where they had some kind of a makeshift tabernacle because Solomon hadn't built the temple yet. The Philistines had burnt the tabernacle at Shiloh, but they still had got something makeshift setting up here and Samuel would, well, he stayed here. He took care of this place when he was a child, and this is where it was at. So this is the Mount of Olives. There's the Kidron Valley. You can't see it because you got to go down. And then that's Jerusalem right there, and we're at Nabi Samuel. There's Tony now on the Mount of this. This picture, looking at the Mount of Olives, with Jerusalem, this place is Gibeah of God, the high place of Gibeon, or Nob, or Nabi Samuel. And so that's where I was. Now Tony's on one of the places of the Mount of Olives, looking down into the Kidron Valley at Jerusalem. So if you see that right here, we're looking at Tony right here somewhere. Now here, Tony is looking at the east wall of Jerusalem. Well, she's looking right here. She's looking right there at that, right now. Right there. And looking where we're at in this picture before. And there she's smiling. And there, Jerusalem, Nob. See, there's high place Nob, high place of Gibeah. These are all places that were the priests would live. All right. Now, the next battle. Now, Nicanor, 20,000 people are going to come out, troops. Now Judas has got 3,000, and this is 165. Yeah, we've only covered, 3 years. I know. Nicanor and Gorgias come down the coast to kill Judas. So they come down the coast, mission, execute Judas Maccabeus. So he was at Mizpah. See, Jerusalem, Mizpah, that's another name for that place I was just showing you. Nabi Samuel, Mizpah, Nob's in there. That's those high places. He's now occupying this right here. There's Modin. So we drove past Modin, go up here to Mizpah, and there's Jerusalem. So he comes down here to Emmaus. Remember the disciples on the road to Emmaus? Jesus and some people are on the road to Emmaus, going from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and that night he broke bread with them. They got up and walked right back to Jerusalem. Says, "We've seen him. He's alive," because he disappeared. But he walked all that way with them. So that's Emmaus, right? So he come up to Emmaus, and, well, here's what happens. They came down to the coast to kill Judas, enslave the Jews and end their religion with 20,000. Just going to end this whole Jewish thing. They leave their camp at Mizpah, Judas does, in the night with their fire still on in the camp at Mizpah. So they leave all the lights on at Mizpah and everybody leaves. Okay? They march 10 miles through the rough terrain. There the Seleucids have set up their camp at Emmaus. They've got 500 cavalry. They got imperial troops. They've got slave merchants that have come along to capture the Jewish people that are going to take them back and sell them as slaves. And Judas is down here circling them. The Seleucids have encircled their camp with trench, with pointed shafts. So they've dug a trench all around with shafts in there. So if you don't know it's there, you're going to fall in the pit and get stabbed. So that's what the Seleucids have done down here by Emmaus. The cantor stays at the camp in Emmaus when Gregorius finds the empty camp at Mizpah. So one of them stays here in Emmaus. The other goes up to Mizpah, going to sneak up on him. It gets, well, the lights are still on, but no one's home. Where'd everybody go? Well, they're all down here. And now they're going to separate these two. See, again, Judas was a natural strategist because he gets them to divide. Well, it goes on and says, they begin to comb through the countryside for them, looking for them. Judas spends the night and feeds his troops and moves in the battle lines to attack General Nicanor, who thought Judas was being attacked at Mizpah. So Nicanor is staying back here. And they, you know, they're watching the game or they're sitting around talking because they know Judas is under attack up here. They don't realize Judas has left the camp or left his home, his camp with his men. Gregorius has gone up there to capture him, but he's been separated. Now between them is Judas. And so now Judas comes down here and is going to attack the unsuspecting group. When the sun rises, the Maccabeans can be seen stationed on the high ground above the Seleucid camp. Judas leads the charge down the camp of the cantor and shatters their discipline, pushes them back into their own trenches. They fall on their own spikes. Judas burns their camp and kills 3,000 Syrians in 6 miles. Judas reassembles the troops back at Emmaus, he assembles them at Emmaus. He forbids them to plunder. You cannot plunder because, right, oh, we're going to take all this stuff. So he's defeated the guys that were back here. Well, the guys that went to Mizpah, they're like, well, what is going on? Where's Judas at? Well, he's destroying your friends down here. And he says, you can't loot anything. And they wait for General Gregorius to come back and you're going to have a briefing and say, we don't know what's going on. So he comes back down to Emmaus thinking he's going to meet Nicanor. But when he gets down there, the Jews found treasure, he ends up defeating them. And now the Jews, both generals are either dead or have fled, and there's no more, the Greeks are gone. The Jews found treasure chests full of gold and silver from the slave traders and enough armor and weapons for the Maccabean forces. The Hellenistic Jews in Jerusalem flee to the Acra. Now there's a place in Jerusalem, it's a fortress. I'm not sure where it is, if it's Fort Antonia up here or if it was down here. There's a place where they were shooting arrows back and forth, and I'm not sure where this place, the Acra, was. It was built over. But there's a fortress there that all the Hellenistic Jews flee to that fortress because now the wholesome Jews are back in charge. Here's that battle we just talked about. You know, Mizpah, they went up here. The lights were still on, and they got separated. 164, Judas Maccabeus is now in full control of Judah. All of Judah is in full control. The Acra was a stronghold built in 167, and the only thing he's got is some Hellenistic Jews are hiding in the Acra. And, of course, how would you like to hide in a fortress? I mean, you got to get food, water, showers. But anyway, now Lysias passes Lydda. This is now Lysias, 65,000 troops against Judas, 10,000 troops. They're going to come down here. They're going to come down the coastal plain. This time they're not going to go up to Modin. They're tired of fighting uphill. So they're going to come down here and go to Beth Zur and march in from the south. That's their new strategy. He's in charge of the western half of the Seleucid Empire, 65,000 troops. He goes down to the Idumean border. Now, right here, this is important for part of our story. Down here below Judah is Idumea. That's what it's called at this time. We know it as Edom. It's the people of Esau. It's Idumea. Lysias cannot counter the attack and withdraws back to Beth Zur, goes back to Beth Zur. Lysias offers Judas and the rebels a compromise treaty. Like at that point, with 65,000 troops being held off by Judas, they're like, okay, what do you need? Lysias then returns back to Antioch, goes back up to Syria. And then, so Judas now is in control of, and the Seleucids, they backed off. It's yours. So now they're in Jerusalem. In December, the city of Jerusalem is in ruins because they've been in villages fighting battles and it's been burnt down. It's been the destruction by Antiochus IV in 168 when he came back from Egypt and they thought he was dead and he punishes Jews. So the city's in destroyed, the temple's in ruins. And they start rebuilding the houses that have been burnt. And the Maccabees destroy the shrines of Zeus that are in Jerusalem. Judas then has to station archers behind a wicker wall to protect the Temple Mount from the Acra. Wherever that Acra is at, they're shooting arrows down. So they put up a wicker wall, like a net wall, so that arrows can't come through, so they can have services. And they cleanse the temple. Now notice right here, December, this is where they reopen the temple and they start the burning the candles or the lamps, but they're running out of oil. And that is not an official biblical holiday, but it was the miracle of Hanukkah. It was the miracle where the oil did not run out. And these lamps kept, they, we don't have enough oil. We can't open the service up and then run out of product right away. They said, well, we're going to start. And miraculously, the lamps kept burning, or the lamp, they got the seven menorah in the temple that it kept burning. And that became the feast of Hanukkah. And in the New Testament, it's the Feast of Lights. So when John talks about Jesus stepping up, going, they went to the Feast of Lights, and Jesus stepped up on the in the Temple Mount and the Temple Courts on the southern steps here, possibly teaching wherever he was at, and says, I am the light of the world. He was saying that during Hanukkah, where everybody's there remembering this event where they went and cleaned Jerusalem and didn't have enough oil, but yet for the temple to keep the menorah burning, and they did. So that it is recognized. It is a holiday. It's not a what we'd say a biblical holiday. It's not an Old Testament holiday where Moses gave them, you know, Passover and Pentecost and Feast of Trumpets and all this. Hanukkah's not there. Hanukkah comes up in 164 is when Hanukkah takes place. Antiochus Epiphany dies in 163. The Hellenists in the Acra, remember that, appeal for help with Lysias, returns with 55,000 soldiers and 8 war elephants. All right? So now Lysias wasn't killed, but he comes back with 8 war elephants. One of the Maccabean sons, Judas's brother, Eleazar, decides to rush the elephant herd, gets underneath one of the elephants, stabs it, kills it, but then is crushed by the falling elephant. When Lysias finds out Antioch is being attacked, meanwhile he's attacking Judas and his troops down here, Antioch up north, they're being invaded. So he's one of the leading generals. He's got to turn around and go back. And so he tells Judas, gives him generous terms for peace. Okay, 162, Demetrius, a royal hostage from Rome, is released. So that's one of the sons. He was sent back. Demetrius sends Elchimus back to Jerusalem with an escort to General Bacchus. Judas' forces are too weak to resist, and Elchimus executes 60 of the Hasidim leaders. That's the righteous leaders of the Jews. So they've got control of the city, but they're still under pressure. Judas Maccabeus realizes he's in trouble. Judas Maccabeus has done everything he can, and they're still coming at him. He's got the city back. So he gets on a ship and goes to Rome. And now Rome is not the Roman Empire. It's just another power player on the Mediterranean Sea. Unless you're paying attention to Daniel's prophecy and you've identified it correctly, you don't know Rome's going to become the legs of iron yet. He goes to Rome for help. Rome recognizes the Maccabean state as its own. They recognize it, Israel or the Maccabean state as its own. You're not part of the Seleucid Empire. You're not part of the Ptolemy. Rome says, we will make a treaty with you as if you're your own country, your own nation, which is a big deal for someone to recognize it. Demetrius, the new king of the Seleucids, marches out to punish the Maccabees for going to Rome. You shouldn't have gone to Rome. Judas Maccabeus is killed. The Seleucids allow the Jews a public mourning time. Judas Maccabeus becomes the Jonathan Maccabeus becomes the new leader. So Judas, they're peaceful enough that they let them mourn Judas. Jonathan is given the position of high priest. So Judas's brother Jonathan becomes the new leader. And the Seleucids say, would you like to be the high priest also? Oh, yeah. So he's the general or the king, but he's also now the priest. So you see, we're getting in that territory of the king-priest title being handed down right here. A lot of confusing things are taking place here and very important. And a lot of it's prophesied by Daniel. Jonathan is given the position of the high priest. Jonathan is made governor of the province and a general in the Seleucid army. So now Judah's brother, Jonathan, is the high priest, and that's right, because he can be a priest. He is a priest. He's the commander of the Jewish, or the governor of this province. They're still calling it a province. Rome says it's a country. So the Seleucids recognize it as a province of our empire, The Romans are saying, we recognize you as your own individual country. And then they also make him a general in the Seleucid army. So Mattathias' son, Judas's brother, at the end of the day in 150, his brother is now a general in the very military he's been fighting their whole time. But of course, it's a promotion, and so all promotions are good. 143, Jonathan is killed, and Simon, the last of the five Maccabean brothers, becomes the ruler of Judea. Judea becomes an independent nation with Simon Maccabeus as the high priest, the general, and the king. So the last of the Maccabee brothers is the general, he's the high priest, and he's the king. He's in charge of the military, he's in charge of the temple, and he's in charge of the government there in the country. The Hasmonean is the name given to the priestly family, Mattathias. The descendants of these Maccabees will rule Judea until 67 BC when the land is annexed by the Romans. This will end the last period of independent Jewish state until 1948. So this will continue until 142 when Rome just comes in and says, you're part of the empire. But that's where they're at right there. And this continues 135. Ptolemy, a general, invites Simon and his sons Mattathias and Judas to a banquet. You know, Mattathias and Judas, Mattathias is the father, Judas is the son. Well, Simon is the last of the five sons. Well, Ptolemy, the general from Egypt, or the king of Egypt, the king of the south, invites Simon and his two sons, Mattathias and Judas. Well, he named his sons after his father and his brother, to a banquet in Jericho at the castle of Doak, where Ptolemy slays all three of them. So they're all three killed. This is the last of the five brothers. It's been a 30-year revolt. John Hyrcanus, Simon's son, slays the man who was the assassin. Now, don't forget John Hyrcanus. John Hyrcanus is huge, and what's coming up in this next period. John Hyrcanus takes the office of high priest and occupies Jerusalem. So John Hyrcanus. 128, the Seleucids in the midst of a struggle for the throne, and John Hyrcanus regains Judea's territory. 125, Rome rejects a treaty with John Hyrcanus because its own internal trouble. They're heading for their own little civil war. Between 124 and 114, a 10-year period, this takes place. And that, all this is laying foundation for when you turn to the book of Matthew and you read the Gospels, it's like, oh, that's how we got here. And in between 124 and 114, you can already see the strife between some people want to be Hellenists, some people want to be Jews, like the covenant. Some people want to be secular, some people want to be holy. John Hyrcanus is not concerned with the Seleucid affairs in Syria. Three parties are developing in Jerusalem. The party of the scribes, which become known as the Pharisees. They're the separate ones. It held the traditional values. Then the party of the Sadducees, which is the priests. So you've got the scribes. See, the priests have the power, okay? It's like the business people have the power. But if you become a lawyer and you learn the law, I can tell your business what you can and cannot do. So you may be a businessman or you might be a lawyer. The business has power, but the lawyer also has more power because he can control the business. Well, the priests control the temple. They've even become kings during this time period. Meanwhile, they're supposed to be following the law. So if you want to follow the law, meanwhile, these guys are over here going, yeah, you're not following the law. And they have talk shows, they have YouTube channels. And they're talking about all these things, saying, you're not following the law. They become the scribes. Why would you want to be a scribe? Because, you know, I want to be a scribe. I want to be a Bible teacher because I believe it's important to learn the Bible. That's where I'm doing it. But in a cultural setting, if you understand the law, you can tell the priest you can't do that. And you can start putting restraints on them. And so now you've got Pharisees and Sadducees are both necessary, but they're two different parties. The Pharisees are the Jewish side. The Sadducees are the priests, but they're more city dwellers. They're more cultural. They're more like the Hellenists. Although when you get back into the New Testament, you're going to find they're living in rural areas, coming and serving their time in the temple. But anyway, the Sadducees, the Pharisees. And then a third group that is developed later was the Essenes. The Essenes, that would be like a, like a generation word. I'm not going to go with the priests. I'm not going to go with the government. I'm just going to go off in my own cave and start studying and teaching and seeking God by myself. Because you're no good. You're no good. I'll find my own way. And that, again, that's overstatement. But the Essenes, a third group that developed was the Essenes. Its members lived away from the politics and kept busy with religious and spiritual activities. And that's where you see they're living down by, the Qumran, the Qumran manuscripts that they found. John the Baptist may have been part of this Essene group, or at least he was in the very, very close to them. That's 124 to 114. 104, Alexander Janus, that's the descendant, the priest, becomes the high priest. The Jewish high priest, Alexander Janus, conquers the Mediterranean coastal plain from Gaza to Mount Carmel. So from Gaza, you know where Gaza's at, all the way up to Mount Carmel. That's, you know, up right south or west of Nazareth, up near in Galilee. He conquers all of that. That's a pretty good job for a high priest. It stretched from Dan and the Hasmonean kingdom. It begins now. The Hasmonean kingdom begins, and it stretches from Dan to Beersheba. Dan is north of the Sea of Galilee. Beersheba is there by the Dead Sea. Alexander Janus takes the social and political conflict between the Pharisees and the Sadducees to the level of a civil war. So he's a Sadducee, but he wants to stop the Pharisees and all their restrictions. So they have now in Israel, in Judea, they have a civil war. The Pharisees are fighting the Sadducees, or the scribes are fighting the priests. And that civil war taking place in 94 AD. As Janus had hoped, members of the crowd who were holding the palm branches and citrons became angry and began to throw the citron fruits at Janus. In response, Alexander Janus ordered his troops to attack and kill 6,000 troops. So he's a priest. He handed everybody branches. They're going to wave these branches, but there's fruit on the branches. And so he is hoping he's going to go out there and make a presentation that the crowd will then start throwing them at him. And he go, whoa, you're doing this, high priest. He'll order his troops. It's because he knows the holy scribes or the Pharisees are going to show up for this event. He gives them, in a sense, weapons, or, you know, not dangerous weapons, just fruit. And they throw it at him. It's like, oh, they're attacking me. Orders his troops. And they kill 6,000 of them are killed at the Feast of Tabernacles. It's called the Feast of Tabernacle Massacre. Now, this is 94 B.C. This is about 100 years before, 90 years before Jesus is born. 94 to 88, there's a six-year civil war between King Alexander Janus and the Sadducees against the masses of the people and the Pharisees. So now you've got a war, six-year war in Jerusalem. 550,000 Jews are killed. 88, both sides are tired of fighting. Alexander Janus asked the Pharisees what he could do to stop the fighting, and the Pharisees replied, kill yourself. Okay, that's still recorded. I mean, Josephus and others are recording all this. The Pharisees then went to the Syrian government for help, and the Syrians invaded from Damascus. So the righteous Pharisees up north, up to the Seleucids, and asked them to come help them in this military conflict. That's 78, and now permission is put to death Sadducees and advised Alexander Janus to execute 800 Pharisees. 69 to 66, Hyrcanus, a Pharisee, is in charge of the strong son Aristobulus. They go to Jericho. Hyrcanus, right here with the peace treaty and the civil war that began in 124 with John Hyrcanus, seems to have come to an end. The Idumean governor Antipater, now I want to get this far, during this right here, 69 to 66, the governor of Idumea, the governor of Idumea, who's there under authority of the Romans, is named Antipater. He convinces the Arabian king to join him in attacking Aristobulus in Jerusalem and restoring Hyrcanus. So you're going to have an Idumean coming up to try to restore the power in Judea, and he's got the Arabian king helping. That's 66. In 65, Pompey, the Roman general, shows up. Pompey is eventually going to go into the temple and pull the curtain back and look, and there's nothing there. He's expecting to see some kind of idol. That's coming up here later on. Aristobulus and his brother Hyrcanus are both appear before the Roman general in Damascus, Antipater and the Arabians are forced to leave Jerusalem. Now that's setting the stage, because down in the Edomites, down here, Edomia, that Antipater, he's got two sons. He's got a son named Phasael and a son named Herod. And he is eventually going to go, and Rome is going to put him in charge. Judah becomes a Roman province in 63. When Pompey arrives in Damascus, he's going to end up in Jerusalem. It makes the land of Judah a province of Rome, and it's going to be that way until 1948 under the control of somebody else. And they're going to put the governor of Idumea over Jerusalem, and so you've got an Edomite watching over the province, and that's Herod's father. And then Antipater is going to take one of his sons and put him in charge of Galilee, which is like the wild, wild west after this time. I mean, who's controlling Galilee? It's on the border of Seleucids or Syria and Jerusalem. And Herod's going to go up there. They've got crime in the street. There's gang warfare. It's like the Mexican border. It's terrible. And Herod brings peace. He establishes peace and proves to the Romans that he can rule. So when Antipater dies, Herod appeals and convinces, well, there's a whole story coming up here. I don't want to spend time talking about it because I want to be respectful. But what ends up happening is in the Roman world, Julius Caesar gets stabbed. You know, he's a big leader. He gets stabbed, and his son, adopted son Octavian, fights against the triumvirate that came against his father. Fights against Mark Antony, and what ends up happening is, you know, Mark Antony, he commits suicide. And Octavian ends up becoming, the Senate ends up giving him the position, and they let him change his name from Octavian to Augustus, Caesar Augustus. But that's Octavian, Julius Caesar's adopted son. In that civil war between Mark Antony, who's functioning out of Egypt, and then this new part of the Seleucid North, Octavian, Herod had to make a choice, because he was now, he had money, he had to make a choice who he was going to support. So he supported his friend, Mark Antony, in Egypt. And when he was defeated by Octavian, Herod was ordered to appear before Caesar, or before Octavian, before you, Caesar Augustus, and is, you know, going to be punished for not supporting him in the Civil War. I mean, I've got a clean house so I can control this growing empire. And Herod simply says, listen, he says, Mark Antony was my friend. And this is the simple answer. He said, Mark Antony was my friend. I'm loyal to my friends. But I can be your friend too. But since Mark Antony's gone, that is all. I will now switch my allegiance to you. And what you saw me do for Mark Antony, I will do for you. And Caesar, or Octavian, liked that answer and then sent Herod back, not just as the governor, but sent him back as the king of this province of Judea. He says, can you fix this mess in Judea? Herod says, I can fix the mess in Judea. And so Herod comes back and establishes peace. Now again, in the Bible, he's a villain, but as far as a political player, he brought peace, he brought organization, he was faithful to Rome. And after this 300 years of chaos, it's nice to see Herod show up and solve the problem. So anyway, that's what we've got there, and we're going to pick that up next time. Here's some more things right here. Here's a John Hyrcanus II, the high priest. This was minted by him. You can see the image right there, the cornucopia is there. There's some kind of lettering, some inscription. It says, Johanna, the high priest, and the community of the Jews is written there. These are some coins. There it is right there. They're all up here if you want to take a look at them. I've got a whole stack of Roman rings from different time periods, going back to the 1st century, going up to the 4th, 5th, 6th century. There's the back of that coin. This is Octavian. I just said Octavian. It says Augustus, and this is his image right here, Caesar. Right now, these are not mint coins. That's why I have them. You see, I mean, they're like brilliantly mint coins. They're in a museum, but they find these coins. I mean, it's like, how do you? Well, once you make them, they either got to melt them down or they're laying in the dust somewhere. And they find these. You can kind of see them. The front of is obverse side says Caesar with an image of Caesar Augustus or Octavian. And you see how it's all kind of deteriorated. I mean, it's worth something, but it's not worth, no one cares. I mean, if you've got a silver American dollar, silver, it's worth a lot more than this. I mean, all of this, you understand, it's old, but it's, And this says Augustus written on the back, which is kind of cool. You can see Augustus written right on there. I always thought that was cool. I got that in Tulsa. This was one of the first coins I got in Tulsa. Here's a minute by Herod the Great. This is this says Baki HPQ, which translates Baki as king, Basileia, and Herod. That's the writing for Herod. This is says there. The reverse side shows two cornucopias right there. So this is a coin from 37 to 4 BC. There it is again, just the close above it. If you want to, there's the ending. Oh, there's a pottery from this time period, from 320 BC, a pot. There's some pots. Some of these things are sitting up here. Those two are right there, from 250 to 50 BC, a Hellenistic. So that's from Israel. That is from that. It was in that time period right there, Hellenistic, from Israel. That pot was in use at that time, and there they are right there. These are the rings. And you can see, they're kind of cool. They're bronze. They're bronze rings. And so they're not, you know. And there's what she's looking at right there. And I've got the little dates on them. Some of them have stones that have fallen off. These are the bulla. And you see the papyrus right here. That would be rolled up like, and we've talked about this before. But here's like a piece. This is an actual piece of papyrus. It's a modern papyrus, and those are modern pieces of clay that I took one of those rings because they've got initials in them. So they're signet rings. You could press like this. Looks like a TJ or TG, and it's right. It's one of those rings I used, and it's got the seven seals. But you usually just have one seal on it. But on the you'd have an image on this side from where you press it. But on the bottom side where I've actually got mine glued on so it don't fall off. You'd have the stripes of the papyrus. And so you can see, oops, this one right there. This is actual papyrus from this time period, 50 BC to 190. And you can see the stripes on both of these. If you flip them over, you can see an image of some, and they're not great. These were found in Israel, and they were burnt. It was from a library that was burnt, and all the papyrus was gone. But when they cleaned it out, excavated, they found all these bulla. And I've got a couple of them there. But I think it's cool because those are lines from the papyrus plant that made the papyrus documents. And there they are. There it is again. That's the bulla. And we talk about bulla. Like if we had bulla and we've got bulla of the kings of Israel with their name on it or their signet, and they actually say, oh, we got one of Isaiah, a bulla that he sealed a document with. I don't have that one. I've got a replica. But that one would be priceless. This one is, I think, get two for $50 if you get in the market right and start bidding and competing. Rome's slow rise from 241 to 1453. Rome began in 241 rising. Here's 63 BC when Pompey went into the Temple Mount, 4 BC when Jesus was born and Herod's dying. It goes up to 1453, and guess what ended the Roman Empire? Now, some people say it's still in existence, but it's been divided up. It's fallen. It fell in 1453. The last Roman ruler was killed by Mohammed II in battle at Constantinople. You might want to keep that in mind. This is, it's like, well, that's ancient history. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's just Daniel's interpretation. That's an eagle. These are two different things. This is something off some kind of a statue or some kind of an incense. I think it's incense because there's a channel for oil to run down. So you can lift it up and run oil down it for something. I don't know what it is, but it's bronze. And that's a Roman eagle from that time period. There it is right there. And that's a Roman block. It says Lexer on it. Lexer right there. All right. This is my show and tell. That's Herod's coin. All right. I'll pray and we're done. I appreciate you being here. We'll be in the book of Matthew. If you thought, well, that was not interesting. Okay. We'll be in the book of Matthew next week, and we'll start again. My goal is to get through this quick. This Old Testament kind of slowed me down, and I appreciate you taking time and being here, but I want to keep moving through so we can do this in a year. So we'll start flying through and overviewing some things in the New Testament, at least the Gospels next week, and putting things in perspective. Thank you very much for being here. It means a lot to me. Father, I do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for revealing history to us. We thank you for watching and controlling history, that we are here today. And just as you delivered those people into what you had called them to, you're delivering our nation and our time and ourselves into what you've called us to. And we ask that we may live faithful to you, knowing that the things of this age will pass away, but how we stand with you and the things we do for you are eternal, and that your kingdom is eternal. And we're looking forward to that. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.